this must not become a forgotten crisis. Both Rohingya refugees and Bangladesh must see the world standing with them.
Calls for greater support of Rohingya refugees. It's Monday, May 17th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Thailand hopes COVID vaccinations take flight. The U.S. capital city reaches a vaccination milestone. A rivalry between big U.S. states. A Pakistani immigrant's love of squash. Remembering VOA's jazz ambassador. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Pope Francis held a special mass for the Myanmar community in Italy Sunday and said the people of Myanmar must not despair in the face of evil or allow themselves to be divided. Francis, who visited the Southeast Asian country in 2017, has repeatedly denounced the coup and continued to do so in a toughly worded homily during the special service for Myanmar faithful in St. Peter's Basilica. Francis has been one of the most outspoken global leaders on the Myanmar crisis. Myanmar is predominantly a Buddhist country and is home to fewer than 800,000 Roman Catholics. Myanmar's military seized power in a February 1st coup, derailing the country's tentative progress towards full democracy and triggering protests that have been met with a bloody crackdown. Ahead of this week's donor conference to aid Rohingya refugees, the United Nations Refugee Agency called for international support for 1.4 million Rohingya refugees and the Bangladeshi communities hosting them. Lisa Schlein tells us more for VOA from Geneva.
The UN is seeking $943 million to provide life-saving assistance for more than 880,000 Rohingya refugees and 472,000 Bangladeshis in the communities hosting them. Most of the refugees, some 740,000, fled violence and persecution in Myanmar in 2017. They since have been living precariously in squalid, overcrowded settlements in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahechich says they remain vulnerable, faced with an uncertain future.
With the refugee crisis in its fourth year, Bangladesh needs robust and sustained international support to ensure safety and well-being of stateless Rohingya refugees. This must not become a forgotten crisis. Both Rohingya refugees and Bangladesh, having generously hosted them for decades, must see the world standing with them.
Mahechich says the COVID-19 pandemic has compounded vulnerabilities for refugees and host communities. So far, he says, the government and aid agencies have managed to prevent the disease from spreading widely throughout the camps and surrounding area. However, he notes the course of the disease is unpredictable, so it is critical that humanitarian aid and protection services are continued to maintain the good work and save lives. He says refugees, like other people, need more than the bare necessities to survive. He says they cannot be allowed to languish for years without the prospect of a decent and meaningful future.
In order to mitigate the risks of people taking dangerous onward journeys, more must be done to ensure that refugees have hope in Bangladesh and of a future back home in Myanmar. Otherwise, they may increasingly risk such journeys by land or sea to find a solution elsewhere.
It appears unlikely the Rohingya refugees will be able to return home soon, as Myanmar is living through a political and social crisis. Since the military junta ousted the democratically elected government on February 1st, Myanmar has been in a state of turbulence, with the civilian population under siege by the authorities. Last year's $1 billion United Nations appeal for Rohingya refugees was less than 60% funded. UN officials are hoping for a better result this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the Myanmar story continues to develop, follow it by following us on Twitter at VOA Asia and on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar army battles anti-coup rebels in northwest town. New allegations made of forced labor at Chinese solar manufacturers. United States calls on Beijing to respect rights of lawyer barred from leaving China. Australian COVID-19 repatriation flight arrives from India. UN agencies call for lower speed limits on roads. Expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more can be found daily at Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram and Twitter as well, and our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Let's continue with VOA Asia. Thailand thought it had escaped the worst of the public health crisis posed by the novel coronavirus through border closure, which has instead crippled its economy. A new wave of the coronavirus infections has killed 400 people since April 1st, the deadliest wave in the country so far. As pressure mounts to speed a sluggish vaccine rollout, Bangkok's main airport has become an unlikely location for shots. Ritra Duong Di reports for VOA from Bangkok.
Checking in for an inoculation at Thailand's main airport, Suvarnabhumi. The few passengers here during a pandemic find empty concourses and abandoned luggage carts as the facility prepares to become a mass vaccination site to help the country deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Check-in desks have been converted to mini-clinics, doling out shots of China's Sinovac vaccine, and waiting areas are used by the newly inoculated to rest and be monitored after they receive their shots. 4,000 airport staff are among the first wave in the tourist-dependent country to receive shots. The airport is accustomed to processing large numbers of people and now being readied for large-scale public vaccinations as the government struggles to beat back a third wave of the virus, the deadliest yet.
Before the pandemic, we used to receive 200,000 international travelers a day. Now only about 1,000 a day. The airport already has all the necessary amenities ready to turn into a vaccination station, such as check-in counters and other equipment.
Over 400 people have been killed in Thailand since a resurgence in the virus in April. Thailand's daily caseload of around 2,000 is small compared to the worst-hit countries, but it is a large number for a country that as recently as March thought it had virtually extinguished the virus with lockdowns and border restrictions. This outbreak has increased pressure on the government of Prayut Chan-o-Cha to speed up a sluggish vaccine rollout. So far, around 700,000 Thais have received two shots out of a population of nearly 70 million. Sarayut Champa is one of the lucky ones.
I feel all right. The shot will reduce the risk of contracting the virus. The vaccine might not protect us 100%, but studies show the sickness will now be less severe if I contract the virus.
Airport workers are on the front line of a country whose economy depends on tourism, and tourist numbers have collapsed since last March. Even though it is fighting its worst outbreak yet, Thailand is promising to reopen its beaches to the desperately needed foreign tourists who have been vaccinated without quarantine starting in July. That means the airport could soon be busy again. However, with public hospital beds full, a tiny percentage of people vaccinated, and an economy in free fall, these are days of great anxiety for Thailand.
I'm still scared because the virus spreads so fast. Even if I'm extra careful, I could still contract the virus.
A kingdom holding its breath, waiting for the pandemic to pass. Wichitra Arundi for VOA News, Bangkok.
China has canceled attempts to climb Mount Everest from its side of the world's highest peak because of fears of importing COVID-19 cases from neighboring Nepal. Climbing was not allowed from either side last year because of the pandemic. Several climbers in Nepal have reported testing positive for COVID-19 after they were brought down from the Everest base camp. China's closure was confirmed in a notice from China's General Administration of Sport. China had issued permits to 38 people. Nepal has given permission to 408 people. So the move reflects the abundance of caution China has taken in dealing with the pandemic. While China has mostly curbed domestic transmission of the coronavirus, Nepal is experiencing a surge with record numbers of new infections and deaths. Still ahead on VOA Asia, how Washington, D.C. has coped with its vaccination program. Happening now in Asia, an official with the Chinese Center for Disease Control said health authorities were actively seeking approval by the World Health Organization for a series of Chinese-made vaccines after the WHO gave emergency use authorization to China's Sinopharm, a first for a Chinese vaccine. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's nice to be able to start a brand new week with you on VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. Washington plans to lift many of its coronavirus restrictions and aims for a full reopening by mid-June. The U.S. Capitol has already vaccinated more than 70% of its residents. Saqibul Islam reports on a unique vaccine drive in the city.
It's a beautiful May evening at The Reach, a new outdoor facility at the Kennedy Center, a performing art complex, where people are lining up to get vaccinated.
I just wanted an easy way to get the vaccine, and this was about as simple as I got. I rode my bike here. It was perfect.
But there are added perks for getting vaccine shots here, which are free of charge and administrated on a walk-up basis.
Ready?
Yeah.
What are you doing this weekend?
People get a jab in the arm and a free beer, too.
There you go. Congratulations on your vaccine. Cheers.
A combination that drew Jonathan, who is visiting the city.
I actually learned about this by watching a TV commercial about an hour ago while sitting in my hotel. So I do travel a lot, so it's very hard for me to try and schedule two shots at once. Being able to come down and get this done, which means I can continue traveling and I can continue traveling safely. A free cup of beer isn't a bad idea either.
Those who didn't really care about the beer were still enticed by the convenience of a single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
People either want the vaccine or they don't, and so, like, incentivizing someone with beer, I don't think is going to, you know,
change much.
But it was, again, that coupled with we want to see the reach, we have this societal pressure, it's just one
and
shot,
got
at least
beer.
It's traditional, we got a beer, so it's like all of that
and fresh
together
air,
and fresh air,
just
yeah.
Just to work out, they did a very good job of this.
Yeah.
Washington's local government and a regional brewing company teamed up with the Kennedy Center for the event named Take the Shot DC, Get a Beer.
There you go, and congratulations on your vaccine.
I think the beer is just a bonus when you come to get your vaccine. It happened very quickly, within 48 hours, so I think it was mainly the mayor's office who made it happen.
Public vaccination events like these are an effort to help achieve the goals set by President Joe Biden to get 70% of the U.S. population at least first shot of COVID-19 vaccination by July 4th.
Is we've got sites across the district that are going to be open every day on a set schedule. But we're also going to have pop-up events like this in order to make sure that our residents have the clear knowledge that the vaccine is free, that it's accessible, and it could even be fun.
City healthcare workers who registered vaccine recipients called the event a success.
I wasn't sure how the turnout would be, but we've had a great turnout. Patients seem really, really eager to get the vaccine. I think any of these events are great. Anything that makes it more accessible to the public.
This week, Washington is ending capacity limits for restaurants, places of worship, gyms, pools, libraries, weddings, and other events. Restrictions for large sports and entertainment venues are expected to be lifted next month. Saqibul Islam, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
The latest news from VOA Asia, an online petition calling for the Tokyo Olympics to be canceled was submitted to the Tokyo government with over 350,000 signatures as cases rise in three prefectures less than 3 months before the games are set to open. You'll find this and all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the two most populous U.S. states, California and Texas, have long competed to attract companies and talent. 2020 U.S. Census data shows Texas is drawing more people, including those from California. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains why.
From bigger skies to bigger homes. Anyone who lives in the Lone Star State has heard the saying, everything is bigger in Texas. By size, it is the largest state in the contiguous U.S. Its population is also getting bigger.
Your quality of life is so much higher here in Austin.
Almost 2 years ago, stay-at-home dad Alex Backus relocated to the Texas state capital of Austin from California's Bay Area for his teenage daughter.
Most of the kids that are in the Bay Area and they graduate, they kind of need to leave the Bay Area because it's so expensive. And I kind of figured in Austin there was a shot that she might actually choose to try to stay in Austin to go to college and start her life.
Backus is a living example of why there is a long rivalry between Texas and California.
They're the most populous states in the continental United States. They both have a sort of a nation-state identity, unlike any other state.
Texas has won the popularity contest recently, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, and the impact will be felt in Washington. For the first time in the state's history, California, a Democratic bastion, lost one U.S. congressional seat because its population shrank slightly. Republican-leaning Texas, the biggest winner of all 50 states, gained two seats. The main reason why?
When home prices in California go up, more people move to Texas.
Out-migration from expensive states like California and New York has picked up during the pandemic.
The states that saw the most out-migration last year are also the states that saw most out-migration in 2019. It just was an accelerated path of out-migration.
One famous Californian who has moved to Texas during the pandemic is Elon Musk, the co-founder of Tesla and SpaceX. The home of Tesla's Cybertruck production and SpaceX's spaceport are in Texas. Tech companies Oracle and Hewlett-Packard, as well as the commercial real estate firm CBRE, have all relocated their headquarters to Texas, known for its business-friendly environment.
But that doesn't mean there's a mass exodus of businesses from California.
Increasingly, companies are looking to diversify their talent base, and it makes sense for these companies to look elsewhere to continue to expand their access to talent.
Foreign investors have also noticed Texas, says Austin relocation expert Job Hammond.
I've worked with investors from Malaysia and Nepal and Shanghai and Beijing and Germany and Italy and even Mexico City.
Backus says Texas may be cheaper and provide a better social life, but its summers are also a lot hotter compared with Northern California's milder climate, rich with outdoor activities.
I still have my home there. It's rented out there, and I'm questioning whether I should keep it because I might want to go back. I do miss going snow skiing.
While Backus wrestles with that question, he'll surf on Lake Austin and enjoy the benefits afforded by Texas's cheaper cost of living. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Making headlines in Asia, protesters in Myanmar staged a flash mob demonstration against the military coup, assembling quickly in Yangon and displayed the now familiar three-fingered pro-democracy salute. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a Pakistani immigrant who is now an American citizen is working hard to build the image of U.S. professional squash in upcoming tournaments. Training was especially hard for Shahjahan Khan during Ramadan, as Sabah Shah Khan reports.
Allahu Akbar.
During Ramadan, Shahjahan Khan and his coaches would break for their zuhr or afternoon prayers. They also would fast from dawn to dusk, as is the custom for Muslims during Ramadan. Yet training continued for Khan, who is looking forward to several major upcoming professional squash tournaments.
I'm focusing on three main events this season. El Gono Open, that is in Egypt, the British Open in England, and the top tournament in Chicago, a $1 million event, the World Championship.
Shahjahan Khan comes from a family of squash players. His father, who was a gold medalist for Pakistan in the Asian Olympics, coaches his son alongside Rahmat Khan, an established coach in Pakistan. Though born and raised in Pakistan, Khan became a U.S. citizen last year and lives with his family in California. Squash is an intense game. Khan burns 3,000 to 4,000 calories in a day and normally eats four meals in a day. That's why training during Ramadan posed such a challenge.
For breakfast before dawn, I'll take eggs, yogurt, more protein in my diet, fruits that give me vitamins. The main thing is to have protein in your diet. For dinner, I'll have pasta, beef, watermelon to make up for the water I lose during training. I take a lot of electrolytes. You can get these in tablets.
Khan also changed his workout routine while fasting.
During Ramadan, I don't exert my energy as much in the court and work more on my strategy. Because I have already trained in the off-season, I just try to maintain my fitness and focus on the mental game and strategy on how to play with certain players.
Like most athletes, Khan's dreams are similar.
I want to be able to prove myself, leave a legacy, so the next generation would know that, oh yeah, Shahjahan Khan, the world champion.
The 26-year-old squash player believes that his journey has just begun. Sabasha Khan, VOA News, Washington.
Today marks the 25th anniversary of the death of Willis Conover, the Voice of America broadcaster who helped popularize American jazz worldwide. Mike O'Sullivan looks back on his career and his global impact on music and diplomacy.
Willis Conover speaking. This is the Voice of America Jazz Hour.
Between 1955 and 1996, Conover had one of the world's most familiar and distinctive voices as tens of millions tuned in for his weekly Jazz Hour. Through the dark days of the Cold War, the U.S. government embraced jazz as a way to promote American values, and Conover helped create worldwide interest in the music.
He believed that jazz was an art form for everyone, but he also saw it as being something that was democratic, something where the strength came from a willingness to listen, a willingness to improvise, and he found those same qualities in the democratic system in the United States.
He was close to the greats of the jazz world, musicians like Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan. Black musicians were immensely popular, but faced widespread prejudice.
He broke those barriers, especially in Washington, D.C., by producing concerts intentionally, blending people with different ethnic backgrounds into groups to perform in the clubs in D.C.
Conover built bridges, whether touring Eastern Europe or broadcasting from his studio.
Let's hear another example of jazz from Hungary.
He once did a special program just for jazz fans in India. U.S. officials sponsored overseas tours by jazz musicians, and Conover, an international star, sometimes accompanied them. He introduced musicians to new styles and audiences to talents like South Africa's Miriam Makeba.
It's always been a music that interacted with adjacent styles, so it's just evolving with as it continues to interact with what's out there.
Conover promoted this cross-pollination and left a major legacy in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe.
People talk about him in Cuba. He's well remembered in Russia, and I think it's a part of his fate is to be forgotten in his own country, but still beloved internationally.
Conover also left his mark on generations of musicians in all parts of the world. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Of jazz.
That's all the time we have for today's VOA Asia program. Stop by again at the same time tomorrow. And in the meantime, you'll find us online at Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our team, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.